Call to order this hearing of the Tax Reform Division of the Senate Committee on Taxes, Wednesday, March 12, 2014. Members have before them the minutes from Tuesday, March 11th. Are there any corrections? Senator Gazelka moves approval of the minutes from Tuesday, March 11th. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The first bill on our agenda this morning is Senator Skoy, 2342. Senate File 2342, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I am here with 2342, Senate File, which is a bill that deals.
Senator Skoy, could you bring the microphone closer? Thank you.
Sure. Which is a bill that is making a change to the county program aid. I've not always been exactly sure of whether that would be an appropriate way to do this or not, but I think it is a way to start this conversation. In Minnesota, this invasive species spread that we're seeing across the state has the tremendous potential to negatively impact Minnesota. You think about the Eurasian milfoil, the flowering rush, these plants that are spreading in our waters. We've got Asian carp coming up the Mississippi River, zebra mussels in many of our lakes. So we are seeing species coming into Minnesota that are not native and not beneficial for the state for our waters. If you start to think about the money and the effort that's been spent in this state just in the cutting and removal of Eurasian milfoil from the water, we can see that it would have been much better off to have spent some resources up front to prevent the spread of Eurasian milfoil rather than doing what we're currently doing, which is spending a lot of money, property tax dollars or Lake Association money and others, to remove the Eurasian milfoil. Now, as we look at zebra mussels coming into Minnesota's waters, it really has the potential to do a significant reduction in property values in the lakes region of the state. These zebra mussels will overwhelm the waters, and at some point, the shells will become the majority of the material on our beaches. They're so sharp that people cannot walk with bare feet on these beaches. And so you can understand that the attraction to Minnesota's lake country would be significantly reduced. Now, when you think about what we can do with regard to the spread of these aquatic invasives, the best way to do is to slow down the travel by boats. And you know, you can think about things like closing public accesses and restricting the movement of boats, but that is not a solution that is very likely to happen. There was an initiative a couple of years ago to actually have a moratorium on just new boat launches in the state, and that had could not get any support for that at all and did not happen. So what we are doing is working with the Department of Natural Resources, and I have their 2013 invasive species report of for the state of Minnesota with me, and I apologize that I do not have reports for all the members, but they are finalizing the publication of this report now, and we'll get this information to you if we are going to be moving forward on this. But what the DNR is doing is a significant ramping up of their educational efforts. And one of the ways that they're doing that is by partnering. And in the report, they talk about how the invasive species are one of the top conservation challenges of our time. They are a very high priority for the DNR. And to address these challenges, the department is working in partnerships at many levels. And as I've been around the last couple years up in my neck of the woods, I know the counties and the lake associations have been spending considerable amount of effort trying to stop the spread of these aquatic invasives in the lakes. So the lake associations, the counties have been committing resources. The Department of Natural Resources is working hard to bring their training programs in line with what they need to do. They have had some success in getting resources through the legislature and other monies to do this work. In the report, they talk about the number of inspections that they have had and the work that they have done with prevention and the containment of these invasive species. But despite all this, there are continuing new infestations of these species. So our efforts are not being as successful as they need to be. And in this report, you can go down the list of counties that have additional water bodies that are infested by zebra mussels, Eurasian milfoil, Douglas County, Otter Tail, Pope County all have new infestations of these aquatic invasives. So we need to be continuing to strengthen our program and to get more proactive in the education and public awareness to stop these aquatic invasives. One of the issues that we had last year was that there weren't enough training sessions to train volunteers. The DNR has beefed up their program there, and I'm not being critical of the DNR at all. I actually think they've done a pretty good job of moving forward in their working with the local units of government. The DNR has hired 120-some inspectors. They have recruited 400-some volunteers, and they did a large number of inspections that they did. They also have made changes that the counties were requesting so that some of the county volunteers could receive a nominal compensation or enough compensation to cover some of the costs that the volunteers are incurring, and they have therefore developed an ambassador program. So the DNR has done 123,000 inspections. They have, 129 watercraft inspectors, 16 DNR inspectors. They've made progress on the inspections. But when you think about the size of Minnesota and the number of water bodies we have, with the land of over 10,000 lakes, we've got 2,100 access points. When you think about the 129 inspectors trying to cover that large number of access points, it becomes apparent that they're going to need help, and that's hence the reason for the partnership with the local units of government. So what I'm doing here in this initiative is trying to find a mechanism to provide some resources to the local units of government to help with this control of the spread of aquatic invasives. And, the DNR has done a good job with its resources going into the pool of volunteers that they would have. I think the local units of government, the counties, would be able to access a different pool of volunteers and really have abilities to bring more people into the activity than the DNR would have. The county environmental services officer would be an area that can be working on it. I think that the lake associations, many of them work with the county soil water conservation districts. So there is this work ongoing within many of these counties to help the DNR in its efforts and to augment those efforts. And this is resulting in some counties starting to have significant costs associated with these efforts. But I think that it would be good for the state to be supportive of these local units of government as they work to try to eliminate the spread of these aquatic invasives. And so what I've done is taken a look at the number of public accesses, and if you want to look a little bit at the bill on...
Members should have a chart, too, in their packets, Senator Skoy, I believe.
Is that a spreadsheet of the number
Well, it's not exactly a spreadsheet, but it's a chart, additional county program need aid for invasive species prevention. I think it's based on your bill.
Yes, and that would be if there was a $10 million...
Apparently they don't have it, but we're going... They do have it. Okay.
Yes, and that would be if there was a $10 million county program aim adjustment. These are the dollars that would flow to these individual counties. And what we did is we took a look at all the public accesses in the state, and we weighted those. We looked at the number of parking places that were at these public access, which we considered as a demonstration of the amount of usage going on at that public access point. And then we divided this dollars up based on usage and number. And we think that the DNR is doing a pretty good job of getting inspections at some of the most heavily used accesses, but there are leaving hundreds and thousands of access points across the state that really never have anybody there to educate the public that's utilizing it. And we think these local units would be the best way to get at that need. And so we looked at all public accesses, whether they're privately owned, county-owned, or state-owned, and they're included in this.
And then that census comes from the DNR? Is that they keep that census, do
yes,
they?
Yes, Senator Ress, yes. This is the DNR information.
Data.
And then if you turn onto page 3, subdivision 3A, the use of the proceeds, the county that receives this distribution would be must use these proceeds to prevent the introduction or limit the spread of invasive species, and they must establish by resolution a guidelines for the use of these proceeds. And so I think we need to, the counties, I assume, are going to come up and talk about this. I know they have questions. I'm also expecting to hear something from the seasonal Rec Owners Association as to how they feel the state is doing with regard to aquatic invasives, but this is an effort on my part to extend the discussion to beyond just the Department of Natural Resources, to bring all of these local units of government who work with the lake associations into this initiative, because when you look at the number of lakes that were infested again newly last year, we need to really beef up our effort because of the potential negative change that could come to Minnesota if we don't continue to figure out how to stop the spread of these. And when we get this report to all the members, you will see that the threats are beyond just Asian carp and zebra mussels, and there's a lot of plants and other animals and bugs that are in our water that are not native. And so I think with that, if we have questions, I'd be happy to answer that. And if there's people that would like to testify, we can.
Okay, we'll take some questions from members before we take testimony, and I'll start. Yesterday, we spent a lot of time talking about the extending the sales tax exemptions to joint powers agreements. And so the whole issue of cooperation among units of government for a common purpose. Would your legislation preclude the counties that maybe, I don't know if this is the case, but if there's any county that shares a lake, if any lakes are between two counties, it seems to me you don't want one county on one side of the lake doing all kinds of remediation and education and the other county on the other side spending their money someplace else, maybe, or not spending it, period, or whatever. And would your legislation, and obviously I'm an author on it, I think it's a great idea myself, but would your legislation allow for counties to form some joint efforts, maybe even a regional effort, where they could develop criteria of where the most important things are, where they get the most bang for their buck, and even though you've mentioned that the DNR has goes to the most heavily trafficked ones to in their pursuit of educational activities, would we need language in this bill to either encourage or allow regional cooperation, or even you know, a joint powers agreement between a couple of counties, or three, or whatever, or would the current law allow them to do that from the get-go? And Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, I think we'll look to Ms. Pollack as to whether we would need additional language in the bill to allow that. But just from
would
my,
you did you like that yes. idea?
Mm-hmm. First of all, I don't want to do anything to interfere with the current relationship that the DNR has established with the many counties that they're currently working with and the lake associations. What we want to do is to try to augment that and try to make it work better. With regard to the focus of this bill, and perhaps there's a better mechanism to focus on, but we're looking at the access point. So if you have a lake that has a county line down the middle of it, County A would you know, do the management and the inspections on the access point that is on their side of the lake. County B could be on the other side. But we certainly wouldn't want to do anything that would impede them from joining together to have one county manage the whole lake for the betterment of both counties. So if Ms. Pollack thinks we would need some language, we certainly would be open to that.
And Senator Skoy, it might also be that one county, of the, even among the smaller counties, has you know, put some has invested in this that other counties might want to that where they don't share a lake, but I can envision them saying, well, we really would like Itasca County to take care of our county as well, because they've got the staff, they've got the expertise, and if it's not a joint powers agreement, we'd still like to be able to contract with them maybe to do that. I would see that we'd want to encourage working with the DNR and the Lakes Association, a wide variety of agreements to address this problem and not be constrained by geopolitical lines. Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, there is authority under Section 471.59 for counties to enter into a joint powers agreement for a purpose such as this one. As far as how that cooperative or joint agreement would work and the allocation of funds under this bill, that would probably be something that the entities in the joint powers agreement would have to establish amongst themselves as to whether a percentage of the
But they're
total
not precluded
funds,
from doing
they're
that.
They're not absolutely not precluded from doing that.
I hope that someone from the counties association will also speak to that about what they think the possibility of that is. I mean, I just think it's 87 counties. There've got to be instances where it's better for three or four to go together rather than one county to do it on their own for the lakes that are in their county.
And, Madam Chair, I think the counties are here to testify. Yeah. I did meet with the counties. They did have a number of questions. There are some fundamental issues about liability that we're going to have to,
sure,
you know, work through and that those things. But those are all details that can be worked through. But I think the counties are here, and I think the seasonal rec folks are here, and I see that the DNR is here also. So
why don't we start with the testimony? And I don't have the DNR on this list, but are they wanting to speak? Not necessarily. Okay, we'll start with Jeff Forrester. Welcome to the division. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Forster, and I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Lakes and Rivers Advocates. We have, you know, thousands of individual members across the state with lake homes or cabins, and lake associations and COLA organizations. I also serve on the statewide AIS Advisory Committee that was put together by the DNR at the beginning of last year. We spent the first year looking at the DNR programs, local programs, what was happening, and we actually came out with a recommendation to the DNR and the legislature that was sent to the chairs of some of the committees, identifying the need for reliable, ongoing funding at the local level for local government units or local units of government, exactly where this is going. And we strongly support this idea. It's elegant in that it puts the money at the local level where it really needs to go. I think, will be effective. When you look at AIS, you know, there's this idea. There was an article in the paper that came out last week about, you know, the silver bullet idea. We're going to find something that will kill these. And we may, but in talking with the scientists involved with that, it's, you know, decades out, perhaps, if ever. And so really the idea becomes something similar to reducing risk, similar to like a health and human services kind of idea, where you're limiting the pathways, increasing the protection, bringing down the risk of transfer. And the zebra mussels are bad, and they serve as a wake-up call. They're filter feeders, so they'll remove parts of the food chain. And then you combine them with other invasives like spiny water flea that remove a different level, and it has a huge impact on fish. And I think we're beginning to see that that might be at least part of what's happening on Mille Lacs right now. They've seen a similar model on the Great Lakes, which are spending, they figure the impacts on the Great Lakes are $5 billion a year. It's a huge money problem once they become established. And there's things that are coming that are worse than what we have. And so we really need to have a program with a sort of a statewide framework. But then as Senator Scoey was talking about, there's a huge need, and really the hole that we have in our program now is local revenue. And it's hard to get a program up off the ground when the money is coming from, you know, one-time funding sources. You can't hire people. You can't establish a program. You can't get something in place. And it's going to take that kind of broad effort at the local level to really give us a level of risk and start to bring down the number of new infestations. I believe when I started on this, there was maybe 30 lakes in the state that were infested with zebra mussels. Now we're at 171, I believe. And that's not good, especially when you look at the things that are coming. And these things start to compound on each other with impacts to fishing and recreation, property values, any kind of water-related infrastructure for the cities or towns. They can have an impact on agricultural irrigation. It's a big deal. So we strongly support this solution. It's outside-the-box thinking. It's nice in that it gets the money where I believe, and I think many others and members of the AIS Advisory Committee believe that it needs to go. And if there's any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Forrester. Before I do call for other testimony, Senator Dejic, I had neglected to call on you before we asked Mr. Forrester to come forward. So if you would like to ask your questions now, and then Senator Gazelka, and then we'll continue with the testimony following that.
I have more comments, so I can wait. I think he has
okay,
questions.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I want to say, Mr. Forrester, I've never put elegant with Senator Scoey together, so it's a
oh, Senator Gazelka.
<It's a first. laughs>
And I say that with all respect. But can you tell me, I know in 2011, I believe it was, or 12, right in there, we passed significant AIS legislation. And I can't remember what number of lakes were infested then. What has it gone to in the last three, 4 years? And the reason why I'm asking that is, you know, I live in the one of the lakes countries, I would say God's country up there, right. Brainerd Lakes area. And, you know, so I get out on the water and you know, I want to protect the lakes. I'm just wondering, you know, what is the impact of what we're doing? Is it going to do anything, or is it going to continue to expand? And it almost feels inevitable, to be honest. And so I want to get some comfort that something's working.
Mr. Forrester.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senator Gazelka, I don't have that number and where we were at in infestations in 2011, I believe. You know, the model, this comes up, can we be successful? And the EIS Advisory Committee addressed that point. I speak at, you know, a number of lake associations around the state, and there's usually someone who asks that question, well, can we be successful? Is it inevitable? And I typically don't have to answer it because some doc in the room stands up and says, well, it's like an infectious disease. A water body is a living organism. The invasive species are like a pathogen. Can we stop the flu? Well, no. But can we reduce the risk with things like hand washing? You look at food in restaurants, and the magic number for killing zebra mussels is 140 degrees. That's also the temperature that steam tables have to be at to keep our food safe. Sometimes do people get sick? Yes. Should we abandon our efforts? No. You know, that's why I think this idea of can we achieve 100%? Perhaps not. Can we bring the risk down to acceptable levels, knowing that every lake that we protect saves us money in the long run? And I think the answer is yes. I think that looking at a difficult problem and throwing your hands up and saying, well, we can't do anything, I don't, you know, that isn't really how I was raised. I think that that's a mistake. When I spoke with Dr. Sorensen yesterday, we talked about this issue, and I said, what I love talking, you know, I love talking to you because you're hopeful, and I am too. And I think the members of the AIS Advisory Committee are hopeful. I think that, you know, looking around the lake associations and the local level, you know, these people are committing a ton of energy to this, giving up, you know, sunny weekends to stand at boat ramps, investing statewide millions of dollars of their own money year after year after year in these efforts because they believe that the lakes are worth that level of protection. I don't know if I've answered your question, but I think doing nothing is not a good option.
Yeah, Senator Gazelka and then Senator Skoy.
Thank you. And I'm not saying do nothing. I live there. I watch how the process works. I watch what we spend money on, and I'm just, you know, I want to get as much knowledge as we can. I've tried to look at other states and that have bigger infestations than we do, and what was the ultimate impact? Did it destroy everything, or did they live differently? And so that's why it's not that I don't want to do anything. I just don't want to waste money on things that aren't working, and I'm not saying things are not. I just want to make sure we're looking at everything objectively.
And Senator Skoy, and as you respond, would counties be able to use this? I guess there's only one with regard to the Lake Superior.
Madam Chair, they would be able to utilize it for their water bodies that have. For their water bodies that have invasive species. So if it's in their plan to do that, I wouldn't see why they couldn't be able to do that. With regard to Senator Gazelka's question, in the 2013 report, in the Northwest region, we have 13 lakes, new lakes, with zebra mussels, two with Eurasian milfoil. In the Northeast, we have 18 new lakes with zebra mussels, one with spiny water fleas. In the Central region, we have seven with zebra mussels, one, two, three, four, five with Eurasian milfoil, one with flowering rush, one with brittle naiad. And in the southern region, we had one with Eurasian water milfoil and two with flowering rush. And I just don't think that we can continue down that type of list. And I don't know the best way to do it, but I know that doing nothing should not be the option. And the analogy that I use, and I understand that the area that we were dealing with regard to the bovine TB outbreak was small and contained. But I'll never forget the first meeting that I attended with USDA and Department of Ag and Board of Animal Health and all these guys. They sat around and they looked at what the other states were doing, and they said, well, we can manage it this way, and we can, you know, do this and put fences up. And the question is, well, how is that working for these other states? Well, it isn't, and it's still spreading, and they're spending millions of dollars, and they still have the problem. And I said, well, can't we do something to get rid of this stuff? And they said, well, yeah, if you buy the herds out. And they said, well, gee, you know, you probably can't do it. I said, well, why not? It's a small number of animals. Let's kind of get aggressive on this. And in the end, Minnesota now succeeded. And I understand that's a smaller example. But I don't think managing this is going to serve the state well. And so I'm real supportive of what's going on with the research at the University of Minnesota. And I'm supportive of giving the DNR some more research, because I really think not everything they're doing is good, but mostly what they're doing is good, pretty good. They had hundreds of thousands of contacts with boaters last year. But we're still seeing the spread, so we need to start getting more weight to bear on this problem to try to stop that, because it is stoppable. If everybody cleans their trailer and everybody drains their boat and everybody does the good practices that we all should be doing when we're moving boats around between lakes, we can contain this. And I personally wouldn't be opposed to closing some unnecessary accesses. I mean, on some of the lakes that I'm around, there's 6 access points. They really could get by with 3. I understand I'm probably not going to get there with that, but where we can control what's happening with those access points, I think we should.
Senator Scoy, even though this is an additional county program aid that is then would be statutorily dedicated, are there any other uses of current county program aid that are not totally at the discretion of the counties themselves? It's a matter of a local control issue. Or are there other parts of county program aid that are statutorily dedicated?
You know, I'm not going to have the answer to whether they have flexibility. My thought is the county program aid goes into the county general fund, and they have flexibility as to how to spend it. So this very likely would be the first in that, but we can verify that.
And then they, Senator Scoy, you would expect that they would be, that they would account for those funds separately, because they are specific in their reports to the state auditor. I'm again recalling the conversations that we had yesterday where with regard to purchases by local governments, things like sales tax was not separately stated, and so they had to do some estimates and extrapolations and so forth. But this would be one, this would be a category of expenditure based on what they were appropriated, or whatever the word would be there, to that they would need to report. Would that be your understanding?
And Madam Chair, yes, I believe that would be the case with this. And if you recall in my opening, one of my very first thing I said is I'm not exactly sure that county program aid is the best vehicle for this, because it's kind of a change to what we traditionally have done with regard to county program aid. It is a statewide program. All counties would be eligible, but it is a variance from what we historically have done. And I know in my meeting with the counties that they have questions about the accountability in the report.
Okay. Any other questions before we proceed with the additional testimony? Seeing none, we have Bo Berenson from AMC and Anna Lee Garlitz. Maybe they can come up together. Mr. Berenson, why don't we start with you? If you identify yourself, please, for the record.
Great. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bo Berenson. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties, and AMC represents all 87 counties in the state. First of all, I want to thank Senator Scoy for bringing this bill forward. Minnesota's counties are deeply concerned about the spread of aquatic invasive species, both for the health of our local economies and for the quality of life in our state. This bill would provide significant new funding to counties to help combat the spread of AIS, and we are certainly appreciative of the interest in stepping up the state's fight on this important issue. We do want to make very clear with the committee some of the limitations or constraints on counties in this effort, which is why I'm joined today by Annalee Garlitz. She represents us on environment and natural resources issues, so she can speak to more of those technical provisions. Our goal here today is to make sure that there is a clear understanding by the legislature on how counties could use this money, if appropriated, and clear expectations on what the legislature expects to receive from that funding. With that, I do want to turn it over to Ms. Garlitz, but I do, Madam Chair, you referenced the question of the joint powers, and I thought I'd address that very quickly. I mean, Ms. Pollack is absolutely right in that there's broad authority for counties to partner with other local governments under the Joint Powers Act. Just reading over the language on the top of page 3, the specificity of the money being used solely to prevent the spread of AIS at access sites within the county, we may need to give some thought to your point about perhaps adding some additional language in there that if you're spending it as part of a joint powers that encompasses the access points in your county, that's an allowable thought. I haven't thought through this quite enough, but I think it might be, to your point, it might be something that we need to revisit in the language.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the other thing that occurs to me as I'm reading this, it's conceivable that we don't want to be as restrictive as just to the access sites. Perhaps there would be some decontamination stations or other things that individual counties might be concerned with. So I think a little work on my part in this area would be something we should be looking at.
Okay. At the end of the presentation, we are going to lay the bill over, and certainly Senator Scoy can take whatever suggestions he hears today into account as he moves forward with the bill. Ms. Garlitz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Annalee Garlitz. I'm the Environment and Natural Resources Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'd like to thank Senator Scoey for bringing this idea forward. I've been having a discussion amongst different county commissioners and different county staff about how this might be carried out at the county level. Under current law, waters of the state are under the purview of the Department of Natural Resources, and counties need to operate under those laws. We can enter into delegation agreements and receive special training to carry out things like inspections and different activities at access points, but we need to sign up and be delegated and create a plan with DNR that the DNR must agree to do specific activities at access points. We are aware of local governments, as Senator Scoey and others have noted, who've either signed a delegation agreement, invested county dollars, or have applied to the state for grant dollars that they've made available. But as I noted, we are limited in the scope of activities. DNR has informed me that counties are able to enter into agreements under the delegation authority with things like watershed districts, lake improvement districts, SWCDs, that's, and as Mr. Burnson noted, that's something that can also be done under a joint powers agreement. So we've been talking about that as well. However, even if a county establishes by resolution, as noted in the bill, the work that we want to do, as I noted, we'd still have to enter into a delegation and a contractual agreement with the Department of Natural Resources. We've been working with the Department of Natural Resources. We have some concerns about the indemnification language that's in current statute. Right now, counties are hesitant to enter into those contracts because of the liability that we would need to assume as part of those contracts. And I brought this up with Senator Scoey, and I've been working on a technical change with the Department of Natural Resources to address these concerns to make counties more able to enter into these agreements, so there's some more flexibility. One other question that comes to mind as we talk about this is that I would want to make certain that if a new stream of funding comes to counties, that the DNR would have the appropriate resources available on their end to work with us to go through these delegation agreements, to have the appropriate level of training activities that are available for counties, because now there's a handful, and I'd have to turn to DNR to understand, to remember exactly how many counties have entered into these or created plans for management of aquatic invasive species, but to have 87 counties potentially entering into these agreements, we're wondering about DNR's ability to assist us in these activities, because we do need to work with DNR on this. One other question that has been raised is whether or not DNR has some sort of a formula so that not all 87 counties have to invent their own education program, their own best management practices, things along those lines. And further, as Mr. Burnson mentioned, we'd like to understand the expectations that the state would have of counties in terms of the directive to prevent the introduction of or limit the spread of invasive species at all access sites within the county. One of the questions we had about is regardless of ownership. There's access sites on private property, city property, federal, perhaps tribal access points. And so that's another understanding that we'd like to speak with Senator Scully about, the expectation of how counties would work with those groups on their access sites. And to conclude, again, we are very appreciative of raising this issue and trying to identify more dollars to be spent on it. We would like to engage in more discussions with the Senator and the Department of Natural Resources and flesh out the details. And we want to, again, ensure that the legislature and counties have a firm understanding of what the county limitations and what the realities are of what can be accomplished through spending these dollars.
Ms. Carlinson, I think the goal would be the maximum flexibility with transparent accountability. And that, I think, you know, those are two good principles to pursue as you're getting into the weeds with these things, literally as well as figuratively. Senator Scoy?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a couple of things. With regard to the delegation agreements, it is accurate. I've met with the DNR and the counties, and we are working on some language there. It is an issue that needs to be resolved. The DNR does have training programs established that they currently are using with counties. I know that last year they worked with Hubbard and Becker counties up in my area on this very thing. There are also appear to be options that the counties would be able to provide personnel to do some of this training. I think there is an example of it's either the Three Rivers Park system or the Minnehaha Creek where they're actually doing some of that, I believe.
Minnehaha Creek.
So, you know, there are things going on that the DNR has been, to be honest, very helpful in trying to work through some of this stuff. This making the change to have an ambassadors program was a very good step forward so that some of these volunteers could get some of their costs covered. So I don't want to interfere with all that good stuff that's going on, but if we can supplement it and help it move forward, it would be good.
Senator Dietzig?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Scoy. I think this is a very creative issue and creative idea. For the record, I'm on LCCMR and on the Environmental Committee, so I'll just kind of quickly run through that the state has put a ton of money in the AIS Center, either through the funding through the DNR and then funding through the legislature, funding through LCCMR. We've done the AIS Center at the U. The LCCMR also funded Zequinox, which is one of the silver bullets to maybe stop the zebra mussels. And then we're also doing a pilot project potentially in the LCCMR packages this year to fund one of the watersheds up north. So just want to make sure as part of this, and part of our money to give to them was to literally come up with some best management practices from the watershed. It is the Minnehaha watershed down here that is actively involved, and that was kind of one of my questions or comments because in Hennepin County, and I'll first say I have no lakes. I have zero lakes in my district. Unlike Senator Gazelka, who has the lake region, but I understand that this is a big economic impact. It's not just an environmental impact, and it's not just an economic impact on the lakes region. You look at Lake Minnetonka and the property tax values we get off of that, and if that all of a sudden becomes a dead lake, that impacts the property tax value in Hennepin County, which is, you know, the largest county. And I know Hennepin County has been involved in this. The Lake Association out there has been actively involved, and the Watershed District has been actively involved. And so to make sure that all three of them, because they already have programs, that they're included in this. And then that was one of my comments was on the access site, because I know Lake Minnetonka is infested, and then it runs from Lake Minnetonka to the Minnehaha Creek, which may not have, you know, some official access point, but it goes through there and then could potentially impact the chain of lakes. And so that it all needs to be a cooperative among all these groups, and then to make sure that the counties include, like the chain of lakes is a Minneapolis lake system, and so they would have to partner with the county and to make sure that you can have that flowing both ways. I've heard the DNR say several times that, you know, just like you can't stop crime and it's too expensive to have a police officer on every corner, they talk about how it might be expensive to have a conservation officer at every checkpoint. But I think this will go a good way to help educate people, and it is a lot on education, and I think you can use volunteers. I know Minnehaha Watershed Creek and the Lake Association out there are actively wanting to put volunteers and help tie in volunteers because they view it as such a big issue. So I think I've hit all of my comments that this isn't, you know, this is something that the Environment Committee, LCCMR, I'll be very blunt. I think I wish Lessard Sams would do a little more, but I wasn't here during all those fights, and so I have a different viewpoint than maybe some of those people, because I think this is a big issue, and I think it is. I appreciate you bringing this forward, because I think it is more than just a DNR issue. So thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 2342? Senator Skoy, do you have any final comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the time in the committee, and to Senator Dietzick. One of the things that I was hoping we would be able to accomplish is give the local units enough flexibility. So if their main water source happened to be the Mississippi River, they would have access points on that. They would be able to do some work with regard to the aquatic invasives that are occurring at that level. So I think we've got a lot of challenges. I mean, we're trying to figure out how to stop Asian carp from coming up into this area. We're trying to control any number of invasive species, whether it's emerald ash borer or other things. So I think we should start trying to figure out if there's a mechanism to put some resources to be helpful. This is my effort to work with local units. It's not going to be the only initiative, but I think it's worth contemplating.
Senator Skoy, thank you. And, you know, with regard to Asian carp, there was a report just in the last couple of days about finding, assuming that spawning had happened in as far north as eastern Wisconsin, I believe. And so that eggs were found, but, again, not an adult fish, but it's a little bit different than just finding EDA and wondering where it's coming from. If we find eggs, we kind of know where it's coming from. So, thank you very much, and we will move on to Senator Coonan. And Senate File 2342 is laid over for further consideration at a later time. Senator Coonan is bringing us Senate File 2436. Which is a proposal for a specific supplemental county program aid. Members have in their packet the distribution chart from 2013 and 2014, and then Senator Skoy has Senator Coonan has a chart from AMC, which speaks to the need that he presents in his bill. So, Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2436 provides supplemental aid in 2014 for counties whose certified aid for 2014 is less than the aid it received in 2013. The supplemental aid is paid in the same manner and at the same time as the regular aid payments. This is a general fund appropriation to the Commissioner of Revenue, and this is a one-time supplemental aid for 2014. And this affects 11 counties. So there are 11 counties that would be eligible for the supplemental county program aid at a cost of $738,182. In your folders, there's a map that shows the 11 counties, and it's also laid out there the county program aid they received in 2013 and 2014, and it shows the dollars lost to a CPA, and then also breaks that out into a percentage. County program aid cuts to these 11 counties happened even though last year county program aid was increased by $40 million. The funding is divided equally between two primary components of the CPA formula, and that's the need aid and the tax-based equalization aid. All counties have received the increase in need aid, and that's distributed based on a county's share of population over 65, households receiving food stamps, and crimes. But the other part of the CPA formula is based on tax-based equalization aid formula, and that's what affected these 11 counties then. For these counties, agriculture lands make up a significant percentage of their total tax base, and the rising market value of ag land in these counties pushed them past the threshold for receiving the tax-based equalization aid. Excuse me. This, again, I mentioned this is a one-time appropriation, so this addresses the issue with these 11 counties just for 1 year. It's my wish that next year, when we're actually in a budget year, we can probably look at a more of a long-term solution, but this is the bill that is before the committee today. And, Madam Chair, that's the bill.
Okay, are there questions? I did appreciate that you said that this is an issue to be revisited long-term in terms of the policy. What I would not like to happen is every year, whatever county didn't get what they got the year before, that somehow we have this continuing grandfathering in so that they're not receiving less than they did in the year before. That's the purpose of a formula, to respond to different needs across the state, and if the formula is inadequate, then we ought to change the formula rather than keep the formula and just keep grandfathering in counties that didn't get the same amount of aid as before, regardless of whether it increased. And I do note that on the chart that there are some that have, or I'm curious, are there any that are on your 11 counties that didn't receive a net loss that are included in your list? That they had, there was a difference, but it still did not result in a net loss. And I see that for Big Stone, there's a net loss. For Chippewa, there is. But, for example, there is not in Cottonwood. Is Cottonwood on your list?
No, it isn't.
No, okay. So I point that out to members. It's only when the counties that are here are only those that when you added the two together were a net loss instead of any kind of gain, even though the gain, for example, for Cottonwood was just the net gain was just $4,000. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind with regard to your one-year fix here.
And Madam Chair, that's correct. The 11 listed saw a net loss.
A net loss.
There are other counties that saw reductions but still had a gain from 13 to 14.
Okay. With regard to testimony, Mr. Clausen, are you present from Chippewa County? Chippewa County, I would point out, if you're looking at the list, had a fairly significant net loss.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Clausen.
If it would be acceptable to you, I would defer to Mr. Geese.
Absolutely. Mr. Geese, Siemens County Coordinator, welcome to the committee, and we'll... if you'd identify yourself, Mr. Clausen, I hope that you would be available for questions if members had them. However, Mr. Geese.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Geese. I'm the coordinator and engineer for Stevens County, and I'm here to testify on behalf of Stevens County in support of Senate File 2436. Based on the current statute, the language that was in place, Stevens County's certified county program aid in 2014 is 24.88% less than 2013. In dollars, the total reduction was $128,462. The annual county program aid now is just under $700,000 less than what it was at its peak in 2005 for Stevens County. This reduction this past year of $128,000 represents a 2% of Stevens County's 2013 property tax levy and 1% of our overall spending. During the 2014 budget development process, the Stevens County Board of Commissioners evaluated and balanced the choices of cutting expenses and services, raising property taxes, and spending cash reserves to account for this loss in county program aid. The cut in program aid was particularly difficult to Stevens County to prepare for, as the final certified aid numbers came midway through our budget process, and the preliminary estimates were indicating a $52,000 increase should have the percentages shared by each county on the previous year held firm. If the formula hadn't made the adjustments it did, we were estimating a $52,000 increase, and instead we recognize this $128,000 loss. Additionally, the supplemental county program aid provided by this bill is particularly timely for Stevens County. Stevens County learned of an Alliance Pipeline property tax court case settlement that was the result of a property tax that will result in a property tax refund of approximately $165,000 from Stevens County taxing entities to Alliance Pipeline. Of that amount, Stevens County will have to refund approximately $77,000 plus interest of property taxes back to Alliance Pipeline. The settlement dates back for 4 years, for taxes payable 2010 through taxes payable 2013. The actions that lead to this appeal decision are out of control of Stevens County officials, and without the aid of this bill, Stevens County commissioners will be back at the table trying to balance additional reductions in our expenditures or use of reserves this year with the possibility of another property tax increase next year to make up for those tax losses. Well, we recognize that if the additional $40 million in county program aid was not provided the last session, the picture would have been much more bleak for Stevens County. Consider if the legislation would have included simple language to say that no county shall receive less CPA than was provided in 2013. We believe this would have produced true property tax relief across the state, and of the 76 counties who gained CPA, they would have received only fractionally less in order to keep all counties whole statewide. Additionally, please consider that the average increase in property tax levies for the 11 counties impacted by this bill was 3.1% higher than the average of the other 76 counties that received additional aid in 2014. For those reasons, Stevens County strongly supports Senate File 2436, and thanks Senator Conan for bringing this issue up. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee for the opportunity to speak, and I stand for questions.
Are there any questions or comments for Senator Coonan or his testifiers? Seeing none, thank you very much, Senator Coonan, and we will lay over Senate File 2342. 2436, I'm sorry, I was looking at Senator Skoy's bill for later consideration.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anybody testify?
Not her. Forcing down. No, it's her. He's just with her.
I see. Okay.
He arranged her.
Okay, committee members, we have in front of us Senator Rest's bill, Senate File 1756.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I would direct members, I guess I don't have, could you see if there's a bill summary there? Maybe there, I don't have it in my packet, but I have the Department of Revenue's review of the bill. There is no cost. It does deal, however, with the series of events that occurs in currently in Minnesota that happens when someone who owns or who possesses a professional license it becomes delinquent in their taxes. And there are there's a series of actions that are taken that this bill attempts to revise to make sure that the license holder who may be or may not be, you can contest it, delinquent in your taxes is notified in a timely manner, and that a revocation of their license, which the Department of Revenue can order the licensing agency. In this case, it was brought to me by teachers. The Board of Teaching, it would not end up being a surprise to them. So the the license holder who is delinquent in their taxes can pay the taxes if they agree with it, and there's no further ramifications. They can also contest it, and there is a time period. And if they are contesting it, it goes to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and then there's some sort of adjudication within, again, a different time period. And if the license is revoked, then, and the case is settled or the tax is paid, then the licensing authority can reissue the license. The Commissioner of Revenue currently needs to notify that licensing authority that a taxpayer owes the delinquent taxes or penalties or interest, and then they revoke the license, or they can't renew a license at that point until the commissioner issues a tax clearance certificate. The change that is being proposed here is that the licensing authority has a duty to notify the license holder by certified mail within a time period, in this instance 10 days, after they've received a notification from the commissioner. So it is really an attempt in making this change to making a streamlined communication to the license holder about a delinquency that has been found by the Department of Revenue that could result in a revocation of their license. And in that communication, they would be required to include the commissioner's notice and information on receiving a tax clearance. And then they would have, if they didn't, they would have 30 days after receiving a notice from the commissioner to revoke the license. But this comes after they have informed the license holder, unless they have received a tax clearance. So it's a procedural change rather than necessarily a change in the outcome if all of those requirements are acted on. And it the point is to not is to be sure that someone's license is not revoked before they even know that their license is in jeopardy. So and that is I think a particular issue in the with regard to teachers who are actively pursuing their profession in the classroom and cannot teach, cannot be in a school setting, as far as I know, without a either an active or, in some cases, I think, a provisional license or a license that has some sort of waivers connected to it. So that's the point of this, and I would call on Ms. Garcia, the president of the Chaska Education Association, to give us a little background about why this bill is even before us.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Garcia, and introduce yourself for the tape. Thank you.
My thanks to the chair and the committee. My name is Gretchen Garcia. I'm the president of the Chaska Education Association, and we serve Eastern Carver County Schools, Chaska, Chanhassen, Victoria, East Union area. I would like to tell a story to underscore Senator Russ's point, particularly germane to teachers, but this would apply to anybody who is in the situation. Earlier this fall, I was notified by my human resources director that a teacher we understood to be in good standing had their license revoked. He had received a letter from the Department of Education identifying the member and saying that their license was revoked. And we had no indication of any sort of disciplinary action. We were not in terms of investigating this member. So we were both really caught flat-footed by the letter from the Department of Ed. I communicated with a member who was equally surprised. In conversation with a member on their prep period in the middle of a teaching day, this is a facts teacher, family and consumer science, working with 7th and 8th graders, met with her on her prep that morning and said that effective immediately she could not continue her duties in the classroom that day because her license was revoked. She shared with me that she was aware that her family circumstances were under duress, that her husband was taking care of things, but she had no knowledge that they had gone to this level and that her license was in jeopardy, much less revoked. So I just wanted to share with you that she's a shy, unassuming person, did not want to appear herself, but gave me permission to share her story. Unknown to me, I was going to have my teaching license revoked. I can't begin to describe the shock and embarrassment of having to leave the classroom in the middle of the day because of unpaid income taxes many years ago. I will acknowledge the fact that my husband and I should have been communicating with each other about this issue, but we didn't. So when my license was revoked without any notification to me personally, I was shocked and humiliated. Luckily, I was able to pay the debt and return to the classroom in 3 days. This was only possible because of the help of my union and our attorney. Many people don't have those resources to help them. Physically living in the St. Paul area was also beneficial to missing less school in that I could drive to St. Paul and pay the debt. So the question of payment was never the issue for this member. Had they been aware of it ahead of time, I'm sure she would have taken appropriate steps to remediate the situation. So again, I appreciate Senator Ress bringing this forward, and just know that the support of our local association in talking with other presidents when I have opportunity to raise this issue, we're not alone in this kind of situation, and our Human Resources Department is also in support of this legislative change. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Garcia. Question? Senator Dzik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I have, so if, the, and I can't tell from reading this, but if they get the notice and they're late, that they're delinquent, are they able to go in, do they have to fully repay, or can they do a confession of judgment and do the and set up the partial payment like a normal taxpayer can, and does that then get their license back? And this might be a question for
counsel.
Yes.
Or the department.
I would hope they would be able to, because as a as an average taxpayer.
To set up a program of repayment.
Yes.
that would be acceptable to the department that would mitigate the need to revoke their license in the meantime.
Yeah, it's called a confession of judgment, and it's
right.
You basically set up a payment plan.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Pollack, is that permitted under the licensing statute with regard to revocation for failure to pay?
Ms. Pollack.
Or failure to file, too. I mean, it's not just, so I understand it, it's not just a matter, the delinquency is not just a matter of not paying what you owe, but if you fail to file for 3 or 4 years, you also can lose your license.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest and Senator Dzik, I'm just checking the statute. I believe that the amount must be paid in full, but I'd like to verify that if I could have just a moment to do
sure.
that.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, so 30 days, and if they contest it within that time period, if you moved into a contested time period, is that...
Then there's a delay, as I understand.
Delayed it for however long it's contested, right? I mean, it's not a suddenly...
Well, I believe there's a time period following that after the case is heard by the Office of Administrative Hearings of 45 days.
Yeah.
I believe that's in there. And that, or I guess it's actually it's 30 days then. No, the hearing has to be held within 45 days, and then... the license would be then revoked after 30 days. I'm just reading from the summary
yeah.
of the final determination, and I would assume at that point that the final determination means that the taxpayer indeed was delinquent and has not paid the what they owed.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Ress, I'm glad what you're doing here. I think it's clear, plus it makes it...
But this is not only for teachers, too, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I'm thinking about all yes. the different licenses. At the end of the day, you know, if your income is suddenly cut off, it just exacerbates the problem. You know, so what you're trying to do here, I think, is a step in the right direction.
Okay. And, Mr. Chairman, I would also just point out that the there is no revenue impact from the Department of Revenue according to their revenue estimate.
Okay. Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, and to answer Senator Dietzick's question, under current law and under this bill, once the commissioner issues a clearance certificate, at that time, the licensing authority could be reissued or issued or not revoked. But the commissioner may only issue the clearance certificate if there are no uncontested delinquent taxes or penalties and all returns have been filed. So as to how the issue of contested delinquent taxes would be applied, I can't say. And whether that would apply to a payment plan, for example, I'm not sure. I think the uncontested issue would be something that would be resolved in a hearing, and that hearing process is part of this bill as well and current law.
Senator Ress, the department may have something to add here too, Ms. Starr.
Mr. Chair, members, just in answer to the question about a payment plan, my understanding of current law is that taxpayers can enter into a payment plan and negotiate a payment plan with the Department of Revenue up to the point of a license revocation. So at any time during the hearing or up to the actual revocation of the license. After revocation occurs, however, the tax debt would have to be paid in full for the license clearance notice to go out.
Senator
Mr. Rez. Chairman Starr, what if... How does that apply if the taxpayer contests it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, so if the taxpayer contests the debt, then as part of the hearing, the discussion about the correctness of the tax liability would be part of the discussion.
And, Mr. Chairman, so if after the hearing was not in favor of the taxpayer then could... pay the delinquent tax and still avoid, like pay it immediately or during that period, pay it immediately and not suffer revocation. The revocation has to occur before you can't use a payment plan or whatever.
Ms. Starr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ress, that's correct. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I really do think this is a good change.
Senator Ress, I agree with you. Anything further, committee members? Senator Rest?
And Mr. Chairman, I would just ask you to lay the bill over for later consideration.
Okay. Senate File 1756 is laid over. Next on the agenda is another Senator Rest bill, Senate File 1983.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1983 refers back to the changes that we made in the the taxation of aircraft last year, and that is, I think, working extremely well, and people are, by and large, satisfied with the new system we have in place. But everybody is always looking for a way of getting around what they're doing or what the law is. The intention of the law. And so this is a very, very technical bill to just clarify the level at which the tax is owed on a base price. And every category is just raised by $1 just to make sure that people are not trying to game the system. And Mr. Hoff is here once again. We didn't think we'd see him quite so soon again, but he's here from the Minnesota Business Aviation Association to speak to the situations that have resulted in this proposal.
Okay, Mr. Hoff. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Gordon Huff, Executive Director of the Minnesota Business Aviation Association. And as Senator Rest has clearly pointed out, when we wrote the bill, we did not realize that between a 999 and 000 that there would be people seeking maybe to register their or saying there was no category to register their aircraft. So we've asked for this slight change to make it up to 000 and then over the 00 amount. And that goes all the way through all the categories. It does not increase or decrease any payment, and it has no impact on the revenue for the state.
That's okay. It.
Any questions or comments, members? Okay,
Senator Rice. Then, Mr. Chairman, I would request that Senate File 1983 be laid over.
Okay, Senator Rest. Senate File 1983 is laid over.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Schaefer-Pellinen, the schedule for the rest of the week, could you inform the committee?
The division will meet again on Monday morning at 9 a.m. to take up a variety of bills.
And
primarily
the full
tax.
Committee is meeting
tomorrow.
Tomorrow
8:30.
At 8:30. For those of us who tend to be tardy, 8:30. And with that, and the agendas have been set out. And Senator Dietzig's bill for today had was withdrawn with her consent to have visits more with and discussions with. With this kind of new idea that she's been working on. Also, before we adjourn, at one of the hearings on the sales tax, I had raised an issue about why the capital equipment exemption was specifically stated in law for telecommunications equipment. And Ms. Pollack has really done just an excellent memo on that. And I don't know whether, Ms. Pollack, did you send that to anyone else but me?
Madam Chair, no. It was just
wonder,
to you and to your discretion then, whether to distribute to the
Mr.
division.
Chairman, Ms. Coonan, Pollack, I wonder if you would do that. And there is kind of an interesting story that revolves around a Supreme Court case that was brought by Sprint in 2005. Do I recall it?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I believe the Sprint litigation originated in the late 1990s and was finally decided in 2004.
Anyway, there are these quirks in the law, and we wonder why a general application is set aside for a specific one. And apparently then the legislature, in reacting to the Sprint case, felt that the proper action to make it crystal clear following the Supreme Court decision, that's why they have that. There's additional language with regard to telecommunications equipment. So, Ms. Pollack, if you would inform not just the members of the division, but send that to everyone, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I will.
Okay.
Then,
thank
Mr.
You,
Chairman,
Pollack.
I think we're ready to adjourn.
Okay. If there's nothing further, we're adjourned.